Today is Wednesday, March 9, 2016. Good afternoon. Welcome back. And let the record show that the House Resources Committee was convened at 1:30 p.m. Present are Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Olson, Representative Tallarico, and myself, Representative Benny Nile. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello to Julie from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO. Today we have a presentation from Mr. Thomas Ryan from ING, a global financing company. Mr. Ryan is a managing director and head of Structured Solutions Group for ING. After that, we will hear from Mr. Larry Pursley from the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Mr. Pursley has a tremendous amount of knowledge regarding oil and gas in Alaska from various capacities. We look forward to hearing from you today as well. And before we start, Representative Heron is present. Welcome, Mr. Ryan. Are you on the phone? And can you hear us okay?
Yes, I'm on the phone. I can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record and begin, please.
Sure. So, my name is Thomas Ryan. I'm calling from ING, which is a Dutch-domiciled commercial bank, and I'm located in New York City. So, I am calling today to provide some feedback on HB 247. I appeared before a hearing in the fall discussing the tax credit financing that we do and the tax credit program in general. And since then, HB 247 has been issued, and so I was invited to give my reactions to the draft legislation, which I'm happy to do. In my presentation, in the first couple of slides, slide 3 and 4, I basically reiterated a little bit some of the presentation we did back in the fall, which talks a little bit about the program, the history of the tax credits and how they work, and then also a little bit of our analysis of the program from a lender's perspective, some of the things that we thought were good about the program, some of the things that we thought were a little bit on the neutral side, and some things that we thought could be improved on. I'm happy to revisit some of those if necessary, but in the interest of time, I thought it might be more useful to just go on to what has changed, if you like, or what could change should the legislation be passed as it's currently drafted. If that's okay with everybody, I'm also happy to maybe go back through some of my previous presentation.
Mm-hmm. Proceed.
Okay. So, looking then at the...
Hold on, please. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that we were all available in the fall when he presented. I think that was maybe to the Senate. So unless I'm mistaken, it would be good for me anyway if he would go over the existing, you know, kind of what their testimony was in the fall.
Can you take a brief overview of your fall presentation?
Happy to, no problem. So it's probably the easiest is to focus on slide 4, which is just a little bit of our feedback as a lender, lending against tax credits on the existing credit program as it currently is structured. So some of the good things we like about it, probably one of the key things is that tax credits are assignable. So if we lend to somebody on the basis of tax credits that they've earned, they're assignable to us, so we can take a security interest in them, which is extremely positive and helpful.
For the record,
to monetize the tax credits is extremely helpful. So again, when you're lending to an exploration or development company that has earned tax credits, it's uncertain that they will ever actually be able to monetize those. And so if you lend against them, that uncertainty would make it pretty much impossible to lend against them. However, because the state does, those credits are exchangeable for cash with the state, that makes them financeable. So that's a key positive of the program. One of the other things that's very helpful in terms of the operation is that the DOR will actually, once the credits are assigned, the DOR will pay the money to us directly, so we avoid sort of the risks of the money getting waylaid. And when it's being transferred from the DOR via the borrower, it actually comes directly to us as the assignee, which is very, very helpful. Historically, we have one of the other things that we find very positive about Alaska in general is that any previous changes to the program have been prospective and not retroactive, which is obviously very important for us, that the program doesn't change as we are in the middle of transactions, such that the laws change retroactively, and therefore we find ourselves in a very different position from when we entered into the transactions from a legal sort of perspective. Alaska state credit risk is extremely good, very highly rated state, and so that gives us also a lot of comfort. One of the things we also like about the program is that it's, you know, willing to support all developers equally. So, you know, some of the smaller developers are helped, significantly helped by the program. So we find that very positive. And then the actual qualification of credits themselves, as in what expenses do and don't qualify, is fairly well codified. And there are clear milestones in terms of what has to be delivered. What has to be done in order to actually qualify for the credits is fairly clearly set out, and and that's one of the important things for us, is that when we're lending against credits, we want to make sure that nothing can come up after the fact that could jeopardize the actual ability for the exploration or development company to qualify for them. So that's a key piece. Then if we look at the more neutral elements of it, one of the things that I guess has been a key, you know, piece of the transaction for, a piece of the program for us is the appropriations issue. Historically, there was an open-ended appropriation, and the willingness of sort of the state to fund the program was always fairly clear. One of the things we're sort of a little bit concerned about, or we're starting to get concerned about last year, was, you know, where the money will come from to actually fund the program going forward. So that's something that we were kind of a little bit unsure what was going to happen. So that's something that I guess is a sort of a neutral point. And then another thing that's sort of we're a little bit neutral on is that the credits are tradable. So while cash refund is ideal, if that's not available, the credits are tradable. Now, that's not something that we particularly would care to do, have to go out and try and find somebody to buy the credits from us if we can't get cash refund for them. But if we had to do that, I guess that is possible. Then looking at the things where we think the credit program could be improved, the appropriation risk is one that's obviously a key for us. Every year having to wait and see whether or not there's an appropriation made to fund the program the following year is something that's very can be very worrisome for us. The governor's veto, which is mentioned also at the bottom of the list, in relation to this, is also something that causes a lot of concern. There is a bankruptcy risk issue in bankruptcy law, which we are concerned about, where a borrower, if it files for bankruptcy before it actually files its tax returns, and therefore, sort of, if you like, once you've, this is an issue which exists at sort of the federal bankruptcy level, where a borrower, if it files for bankruptcy before it actually files its tax returns, then there is some uncertainty as to whether or not the assignment of those credits in the previous year would be respected by the bankruptcy court. So one of the things we were hoping we could get, would wish for in an ideal world, is that we could sort of clarify that point and take that risk off the table. And then the delay in the lien perfection is a related point, which it's essentially the same issue. So I apologize, I kind of went through that a little bit quick. There's a lot of material in there. I'm happy to sort of take questions on that at the end, or we can do it now, but maybe in the interest of getting through everything, maybe we should just keep going. And if you want to come back to some of this stuff at the end, I'm happy to do it. Does that make sense?
We have a question here. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
We have a question from Representative Seaton. Go ahead, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wanting clarification. You said the certificates were tradable. Are you meaning that they're tradable among financers instead of just among oil companies, those qualifying, or those going to apply them against tax credit?
What I meant was credible amongst taxpayers. So if we have an entity that never actually has taxable income and can use the credits themselves, and they're not exchangeable for cash, there is the opportunity to go and trade those and sell them to another taxpayer who could use them against their tax liability.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Okay, so then just looking at that bill, before we get into HB 247, I guess one of the things that we acknowledged at the fall presentation is the world has changed significantly, right? Given what's happened with commodity prices, and given the size of the program as it has evolved in Alaska, we recognize that the program is unsustainable in its current form, and we welcome modifications to it. We ourselves, as a lender, I guess in many ways we're reasonably agnostic as to the size of credits. The only thing we ask is that the payouts on those credits and so on be predictable, and that any changes be prospective. And so, from our perspective, what we were asking was that if we could solve the appropriations issue, and we could make any changes that were prospective and added some clarity to the program for us, that would be an improvement for us. And as I said, we're reasonably agnostic as to the actual size of the credits. Now, having said that, and I'll come back to that in a little while, obviously, if the credits are so small that our borrowers go out of business and then can't complete their projects, that is a bad thing for us. But in terms of the operations of the program itself, what we're looking for is more predictability in terms of appropriations and in the functioning of the program. So then getting into, and I think it's probably easy that the way I presented this is I listed off sort of the risk issues that a bank like ourselves would worry about in a program like this, and then I kind of went through what sort of the consideration is, and then what does HB 247 actually do to make that risk worse or better? And then to the extent it made it worse or was neutral, I'm trying to offer potential solutions as to how it could be changed in order to sort of make it function better for us. So I'm on slide 7 now. So looking then at the borrower liquidity, for example. So, you know, borrowers require sufficient liquidity to continue to finance exploration and extraction activities over the medium term. The tax credits obviously are a significant source of liquidity for a lot of these borrowers. One of the things that HB 247 does is it limits the cap of $25 million per year that are refundable. This then, for us, from a liquidity perspective, is problematic. We all know that drilling in Alaska is incredibly expensive and can be very unpredictable. And so the low level of refundability for credits that have historically been earned, they actually are earned, but the payout is capped at $25 million per year, just puts these borrowers in extreme under liquidity pressure. So I guess one of the things that would obviously fix that would be that if there is a bankruptcy event or these entities go out of business or are acquired, one of the things we would ask is that we would continue to be able to earn out the $25 million, and let's assume the $25 million continues to be the cap, that we would continue to earn to be able to receive that money going forward. So this, again, just comes down to the functioning of the program. It's assignable to us, we hope. It gives us a senior claim on it. If there is a bankruptcy, that claim is respected, and that then we can continue to earn the credits as they're paid out over time, and that they don't stop when the borrower goes bankrupt. So that would be a key element of any cap that we would be able to continue to earn out if our borrower no longer exists or is bankrupt or has been acquired by somebody else. The tax credit qualification risk is a key issue for us. I think I mentioned it earlier, is that one of the things we need to be able to do is to rely on the fact that once the credit's earned, that they will become the the property of the borrower, and then in turn can be assigned to us. If there is a performance component, which happens after the fact, then that obviously is a concern for us, because if the company doesn't comply with that, or we can't in a way comply on their behalf, then there is a danger that the risk of the credits are no longer available. The addition of employment requirement in HB 47 does cause some concern there, because what if the borrower doesn't comply with that? Then does the credits go away? Do they cease to be refundable? And then how does that affect us? So one of the things that would be helpful to us is either, obviously, if that wasn't there, then that would be the easiest, because then once the credit's earned, then we just can continue to pay the refunds. But if it is important that this stays in, then what we would look for is a way that we can satisfy it on behalf of the borrower. If the borrower either doesn't satisfy it or goes out of business, then we can, on behalf of the borrower, somehow satisfy it or quantify it in a monetary value that we can compensate the state for the fact that they didn't comply with it. But there is some way that we can satisfy it in a quantifiable way, such that we continue to earn, be able to claim the refund for the credits. The lien perfection risk is something I spoke about earlier. That's where we worry about a bankruptcy of our borrower before we actually have a perfected claim. One of the things we had asked for in the fall is that if there is legislation that somehow strengthens that analysis and reduces that risk for us, we don't see anything that we see in HB 247 that changes that position, so that's still the neutral. But if we could change something, we would ask that somehow the legal position in a bankruptcy be somehow improved, or at least the security interests be stronger in the case of a bankruptcy.
Well, a question from Representative Seaton, sir.
Thank you. So I guess I'm hearing you're not opposing the cap, but you want to be able to own the credit certificate and then get it reimbursed at that cap amount in future years. But you're also wanting us to protect you from federal bankruptcy law by saying something like, if they're the state's general fund will be liable even if the federal bankruptcy takes some of that credit obligation and absorbs it to other creditors. So is that what I'm hearing you ask?
Yes. Yeah. Essentially, yeah. So I guess the bankruptcy risk happens in one of two ways, I guess. One is there's a bankruptcy before the tax returns are filed, and therefore you actually have an assignable tax credit, if you like. So that's the first. The second, then, is what happens during the earn-out period while you're waiting for the cap, as you said, because the refunds are capped, the term over which you get paid out is longer. We would ask for some clarity as to what would happen in that instance. So if there was a bankruptcy, then what would happen to those unclaimed or unrefunded credits? Would they continue to become the property of the assignee, and he can continue to pay the refunds long after the company is gone? So there's kind of two separate elements. So I think the second element is the one you were focused on, and that's correct. That's something we would ask for.
And
follow-up.
So I guess I'm just trying to figure out, is that kind of like a double payment if the bankruptcy court would come back and say that asset is assigned to a secured creditor, and you're asking for, since you loan money on those ahead of time, that the state should basically double pay, having already given that assignment to, if the bankruptcy court assigns that to another creditor, we're supposed to somehow obligate further money from the general fund to pay the tax credits? Just trying for clarity here.
Truthfully, I don't know that I'm being that specific as to how it would be solved. I'm not sure that I have a specific solution in mind. That would be one solution, where the state says, well, if the credits that we already agreed to and that were assigned to ING in this instance were suddenly sort of reassigned to somebody else in the case of bankruptcy, that we would pay twice. I guess that would be a solution. But without having spent a lot of time with sort of bankruptcy attorneys and legislators, I don't know if there's another way to fix it legally such that that situation couldn't arise. I'm not saying that that's the only answer. That certainly would solve it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Ryan it is, right? So I took debtor-creditor law course, but it was a very long time ago, and I know something about perfection of liens and that sort of thing, but you're not asking that if there is a vendor of a product in the Cook Inlet in South Central Alaska who can, using secured transactions under the Uniform Commercial Code or some other UCC code, get a security risk and a lien of some sort. You're not saying that you should always get in the queue before that creditor, are you?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but I think I'm saying yes. If we are lending against these tax credits, and they are assigned to us, and we have a UCC, perfected UCC filing, or UCC claim on those credits, then that seniority should be respected in the case of vis-a-vis other creditors, unsecured creditors. Is that your question?
Yes, if can I follow up? But you're not asking for some statutory presumption of seniority, which we may not be able to afford you anyway under federal law. You're not asking. You're asking for. I'm not sure what you're asking for that we can guarantee you.
I think we've done that.
So the bankruptcy code, as I understand it, and as our experience has been, is a lot of times it's very fact circumstance specific. And when we discussed this in the fall, we don't have. I don't believe there is an easy fix for this. But there's a statutory, state legislative fix for this. But one of the things we were asking is that if we could, in some way, create legislation which made it clearer that from the state's perspective, it was the intention that the assignee of tax credits should rank senior to all of the creditors in the case of a bankruptcy prior to the actual filing of the tax return. That would be a helpful fact should the situation arise where there is a bankruptcy prior to the filing of the tax return. Now, again, I, like you, I'm not a bankruptcy expert, but in discussions with our attorneys, they suggested that some helpful legislative language in Alaska would be very, very helpful should that situation arise. And so I think what our ask was at the time is if there is going to be changes to the credit program, that we could somehow add language that would improve our position in the bankruptcy that would be helpful.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's the same page but a slightly different subject. Same page of the PowerPoint. May I?
All right.
Mr. Ryan, you said at the top of the page that you would that you're concerned with the $25 million cap, although you said you're agnostic on that, is that it increases the risk of bankruptcy. And I'm just, before all credits are paid, I'm just wondering about that. It seems like there isn't, I'm not a financier, but it just seems that if you had a more conservative-paced exploration and development project that wasn't absorbing lots of credits suddenly, that might be a sign of more predictability and stability. Isn't there some logic in what I just said, or is there not?
So, I think I understand. Well, I'm not sure I do understand your question. Maybe you could ask again. I apologize.
Well, if looking at your PowerPoint page 7, there was an uncapped system like there is now, and someone suddenly qualified for $100 million all of a sudden.
Right.
Isn't there some risk associated with that? Or does it not speak to, I don't know, a more conservative approach to exploration development? A more sort of cautious practice of borrowing, because after all, they have to match what we're paying. Their match is 35 cents or it's 45 cents.
So the cap is in the amount of the refund in any given year. So let's assume that, just take an example, a project spends $100 million in a given year, or let's say it qualifies for $100 million credits in a given year in the first 2 years. So under the existing system, and there's no cap, they would get that $100 million, let's just say for the sake of argument, 9 to 12 months after the date of the filing of the tax return. So when we finance them, number one, it's a short-term transaction for us, so the interest rates are very, very low on that because we expect to get the money back fairly quickly. And the advance rates, as a result, are higher. So they pay less interest, and they get more of that money quicker to pay their bills and to stay liquid and to stay in business. If they're capped in the amount of refunds to $25 million a year, and they get it over a 4 or 5 year period as a result, then the amount of interest they pay, the advance rates against that we lend against them, so now it's a longer-term loan for us, so the interest rates are higher, the advance rates are lower against the same amount of credits, and so they get less cash. There's also the risk that if they get into trouble in the short term, what will happen to those credits? And if there's uncertainty around that, then we may not be willing to lend against the full amount. Maybe we'll only lend against the first 2 years of the credits. So the amount of money they're getting today for the credits that they've already been entitled to, but which won't be paid out over a longer period, is a lot less. Is that?
Yeah, actually, thank you. That helps explain your context. Thanks.
Representative Heron.
Yes, Mr. Ryan, I'd like to, if we could, return briefly to the tax credit qualification risk and those three blocks across there. I mean, Alaska hire is near and dear to us up here for a lot of reasons. So why are you asking for a solution when you know the lay of the land here?
So, I'm absolutely entirely sympathetic and to the situation. And hiring in Alaska is again, from my perspective, shouldn't really matter in terms of, you know, the or willingness to lend against the credits. However, if it's a future obligation to hire Alaskans, which again I'm fully supportive of, and I think. That's not my issue. Then what happens if the company doesn't comply with that? Then the company doesn't any longer qualify for the right to get a refund of the credits, and so I'd lend them money against a credit that then just or against a refund of a credit that then just doesn't materialize. And so I make a significant loss on that loan simply because the company didn't comply with its requirements to hire a certain number of Alaskans in a given period. And so all I'm asking for is, ideally what I'm asking for is there a way that if that should happen, that I can actually perform that responsibility on their behalf in order to continue to qualify for the refund of the credits? Just so I can ensure compliance with the requirements.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you for that answer. I believe, though, is I'm not a lender except to family. Sometimes that doesn't work out either. It's of course in your best interest that the company does maintain that Alaska hire. So it seems somewhat odd for me as a policymaker to say, we're going to protect you when actually the company should be protecting you.
So yeah, that's a pretty good point. And then it's probably worth thinking a little bit about the different kinds of financing that these companies can get. If I wanted to take quote unquote operation project success risk on this company, which I could do, I could say, well, you know, I want to take risk that you're actually going to be successful and how to take the risk that you're actually going to hire all the people that you say you're going to hire and so on and so forth, then I would not be a secured bank lender charging, you know, 5, 6, 7% interest on my loan. I would be an equity investor or some kind of mezzanine investor earning 17, 18% return on my money. So this is purely about trying to keep the cost of funding for these companies as low as possible. I'm the cheap funding here. I'm the guy who comes in on a secured basis and doesn't take a lot of project risk. I'm the cheap money. If I come in and take a lot of project risk, which would mean then if the company isn't successful and doesn't hire the people, that I'm going to lose my money, that's fine. But then I would expect a much higher return on my investment because I'm taking much more risk. So what you're saying is perfectly valid for somebody who's taking equity risk on a project. That wouldn't be the case for me. It's just a different type of credit. Is that?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Proceed.
Okay. So, and just going down, I think the point on intercreditor risk, which is a little bit related to that last point, which is there are different sources of capital for these projects. And in the case where the credits were at the levels that they are at now, with the refund program that's there now, the tax credit component and therefore the cheap bank financing component of the capital structure of these borrowers is a lot larger, which means that they need less of the really expensive money and they need less of the sort of the equity investors in the projects, which, you know, the more equity you require, the more control you have to give up, and the more bargaining power that the company and the banks have. If you switch the mix so it's more risky capital and less credits and bank financing that then, you know, sort of monetizes those credits, then the bargaining power of the banks sort of is reduced significantly, which means that we have much less control over how the loans are structured and the terms and the operations of the borrower. So that does increase our funding costs a bit. That makes our funding more expensive for the borrower than it currently is. Does that make sense? Then the appropriation risk, and this is one that we mentioned earlier, that, you know, the annual appropriation process has become a little more unpredictable and causes us some concern. In HB 247, there is a solution to the short-term appropriation issue in that it does contain large appropriation to cover all credits sort of that had been earned up to the point of the change of law. And so that's helpful. That's definitely helpful because it covers credits up to July 1st. However, it increases the appropriation risk on the back end because now we have these longer-term earnouts and there's no certainty that the appropriation and the funds will be there to pay those credits over a longer period of time into the future. So that's why we have a sort of green and a red box here, and that it certainly provides a significant improvement on the short term, but then sort of continues the risk for the long term. And something we would like to see there is either a legislative or permanent funding fix that if we are going to have this cap of, let's say, $25 million a year over several years for the credits, that there is somehow something put in place that essentially removes that annual appropriation risk, if that's possible. That's something we've asked for. The construction project operating risk, this is, I guess we've kind of touched on this a little bit already. Again, one of the things that the credit program sort of creates for us is certainty that there will be cash to pay back our loan. We don't necessarily take success risk on the project. By putting this annual cap on when we can sort of get the refund, that pushes that repayment much further out into the future. And so it does increase the risk that there is a significant event in the future where the projects don't get completed, and so we are faced with an issue in terms of getting our money back in the future. So I think we've covered this point in a couple of times already in different issues, but one of the things I'm trying to do with these slides is to go through the risks as they were presented in our original presentation, just to see what's changed. So I guess I'm a little bit repeating some of the points we've covered earlier on the slide.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to analyze risk here and the level of credits and the amount that's needed. It seems like what you're saying is that the credits give the opportunity for someone to get a lot more reasonably priced capital without bringing in partners, but if they would work in the normal sense of bringing in partners with good balance sheets, there's less risk for you because you have more parties that have stronger balance sheets than in the case where we have a single small company relying on the financing by the credits, and therefore we get into the bankruptcy system. So I guess I'm trying to figure out the balance. You were saying you didn't mind the cap, that wasn't your portion of the problem, but it was the payout later. But I guess the problem is, the question is, the more the credits, doesn't that give you greater risk because you have smaller companies just working off this loan capital instead of having a balance sheet that will support the project risk?
I think that's right. And I think I think one of the things we liked about your program is that it allows us to bank some of these smaller companies. I think, one of the objectives I thought of the credit program in general was to encourage these smaller exploration companies. The larger oil companies, oil and gas exploration development companies, have significant balance sheets of their own. So, number one, they don't particularly need our funding. Number two, they allow them to have tax liabilities, and so they can actually use the tax credits anyway, so they don't need to finance them. So, one of the impacts, I think, of the changes will put some of these smaller companies out of business and will sort of, they won't be doing the projects that they currently plan to do. So that means there's less business for us, too. If that's your question.
I'm just trying to, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to balance the risk situation, the amount of return here, and also the creation of bigger risk by having smaller companies not taking on other partners to have a stronger balance sheet to undergo these projects, and then asking for bankruptcy protection in the situation. So just trying to balance that.
So I guess by reducing the credits, you do force these smaller exploration companies to partner up with either companies with larger balance sheets or to find larger sources of equity funding if they can, as opposed to sort of being able to finance themselves on a standalone basis by monetizing credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
So then the interest rate risk is a fairly neutral risk. This is just a purely an operational issue of the loans in that we have draws that happen sort of periodically, and then when they're drawn at the interest rate prevailing at the time. And then the interest rates are set for the period of the loan, which is the period from the date of the draw to the date the credits are paid out or the refunds are paid out. So to the extent the terms get stretched out by the cap, that just increases the interest rate exposure because you're dealing with interest rates over a longer period of time. But again, this is a marginal issue. It's easy to hedge that risk. So there's a slight cost associated with it, but it's not a particularly material issue one way or the other, and HB 247 doesn't really affect it that much. And then the change in law risk, which is one of the ones we mentioned earlier, which is particularly important to us, is that any laws be prospective rather than retroactive. I think one of the things that I think that the governor and the legislature in Alaska are all being very careful of, and we really appreciate that, is that they're being very careful to make sure that any changes to the program are prospective. And that's been helpful. So that's one thing that clearly is very, very clearly spelled out in HB 247. in terms of potential fixes, I don't think there's anything that sort of needs to be done there. It would be nice if the effective date was pushed back a little bit further in 2016, just to give us more time from once the legislation was finalized to actually get our deals restructured if necessary. So a little bit more time would be helpful, but it is prospective, and that is important. So I guess that's it. The slides just cover a little bit of our background of the company, some of the other things we're active in, in our position in the oil and gas and exploration field. I think one of the things that's probably worth mentioning is because of the uncertainty around the changes to the program, we haven't closed any new deals since the fourth quarter of last year. And right now our advances against 2016 credits are on hold pending some clarity as to what the changes to the program are. So the sooner these things can be sort of clarified, the better for everybody.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you say the advances for 2016, you don't mean fiscal year 2016, you mean calendar year 2016.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, yeah, calendar year 16.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. And just to follow up, I think I got it, that you were saying early on in the slides there that you actually wanted more predictability and that the size or percentage wasn't the size of the loans or credits wasn't the issue with you as much as the predictability of the repayments. Is that correct?
So yes and no, and I apologize, I don't mean to be circuitous, but so yes, we are agnostic. Predictability is key for us. However, if the credits get to the point where they're stretched over too long of a period or are too small, then that increases other risks. And the other risks include, the success of the project, the viability of the borrower, potential bankruptcy issues should they indeed file for bankruptcy before we get all of our money back. So for banks, in an ideal world, our banks like our money to come back quickly and predictably. So anything that stretches out the repayment period is an issue for us.
Follow up.
So the size or the percentage of the credits that are issued, in fact, you're probably happier if the credit percentage is smaller because that represents less portion of the project itself, but you want very predictable repayment terms. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to understand exactly where you're.
So if it's smaller, that doesn't necessarily mean. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. Just because it's smaller doesn't mean it's less risky. I mean, we generally look to the enforceability of our claim to get the refunds. We look to the credit worthiness of the state of Alaska. So, in fact, the larger the credits, that means we can advance more, and that's better for us. For the same amount of effort, we can do larger deals. Smaller credits means we're doing smaller deals, so we obviously earn less.
the creditworthiness of the state of Alaska hasn't changed. We're just now doing a smaller deal. And the viability of our borrowers and the bargaining is now diminished, right, because they had less credits. And the bargaining power of the equity investors has gone way up because they're putting in much more of the money. So while, you know, as I said, the size of the credits were kind of agnostic, at a certain point in time, the credits become too small, and it jeopardizes both our business and the viability of our borrowers, and then it becomes then sort of detrimental to the program for us. Does that make sense?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So what you're saying is that you're really not having to do too much due diligence on the project at all, because you're relying on the enforceability of the claim and the balance sheet of the state of Alaska, not that of the project sponsors, really. And so you look more to those two items, enforceability of claim, I think you said, and the balance sheet of the state of Alaska, as whether you're going to make the loan and whether the project, has problems or not, other than somebody going bankruptcy before the credits are issued, wouldn't be your worry. Is that correct?
No, actually, I'm kind of saying the opposite. Is that from a creditworthiness, if I'm worried about getting my money back, I can not get my money back for one of two reasons. I can not get my money back because the state of Alaska doesn't pay out, or the state of Alaska defaults, or goes bank, you know, and that's obviously a very, very small issue other than the appropriations issue. The actual creditworthiness of the state is, you know, it's exceptionally high, so that's less of a concern. So the appropriations, more appropriations than creditworthiness. But I actually do care a lot about my underlying companies, and I think I've said that several times. The bankruptcy is one thing, but I like my companies to stay in business. I like my borrowers to be viable, to be liquid, and to be successful. So we do care a lot about the underlying borrower. Even though, clearly, if everything goes to plan, the company doesn't file for bankruptcy, stays in business, and our security interest is perfected, then what we really have is state of Alaska risk at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever said I don't look at the viability or care about the viability of the project. In fact, it's the opposite.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean that you didn't care at all, but that your issues and your security was really with the state of Alaska. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 7, in that same sort of bottom right box, which I think is what Representative Seaton was speaking from about the annual refund cap, this is an issue that's come up in other conversations, and it sounds like you're just saying you don't have a specific number. I guess it seems like from the lending perspective that might be interesting, because when we looked at some graphs prepared by our Division of Taxation, you know, one showed without the cap, you know, you could be getting into hundreds of millions of dollars for your early years in development versus having a $25 million cap. I guess it seems from a lender perspective you might have some insight into, you know, the area in between those numbers. If you're saying that, you know, increasing the annual cap might be a possible solution. And then also you say for smaller explorers and developers, and I just want to make sure, you know, we sort of talk about explorers, development, and then operators. Are you talking, you know, like the developers are also the operators, or you're talking about the stage of development for projects prior to them being in operations?
So I think I understand. So there's two questions. So the first question, you were asking me, do I have a number in mind between the $25 million and the 100% refund? You asked me to suggest a number, or just a general question of how do I feel about something in between the two? Sorry, can you maybe...
Sure, through the chair, yeah, we have a $25 million cap in the bill, but, you know, in some previous graphs that we've looked at, you know, it looked like early, you know, in the fourth, fifth, sixth year, you know, for a project build-up without that cap, you know, there could be spending in the three, five, $700 million range. So there's a pretty significant gap between the two.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder from a lender's perspective if you have anything to offer there.
So, again, it's a balancing act between, number one, we would like to see the program be sustainable and to be, the kind of program that everybody is supportive of in the current, oil and gas price environment that we're in. And we recognize that the program is has gotten very, very big, and the annual payouts are extremely large. So we would like to see, or we're happy to see a reduction in the amount of payouts. Obviously, as well, the longer the term of the repayment, so caps actually in some ways are good for us, right, because it means the money is outstanding longer and we earn more interest. So it's a case of reducing it, and even extending it is also good for us, but not so much that it actually jeopardizes the project. So where is the right number? And that's actually a very difficult question to answer. I don't know that I have one, to be honest, for you. But certainly somewhere in between is I think the ideal answer. Where is it? Is it halfway in between the two? I actually, it would be very, very difficult to answer that question, and it's probably different by project as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be unhelpful, but I don't know that I have an easy answer for you. And then the second question, what was the second question?
Thank you. Through the chair, on that same bottom box where it says, refund cap for smaller explorers and developers, and I just want to, you're saying those words, understand what you're suggesting so I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so our interest, if you like, is in companies before they're actually paying tax. So in our mind, the exploration and development phase are when they're spending the money and they're actually not earning any revenue. Once they're in production, then they're actually earning revenue. They're paying, in theory, paying taxes, and they can use the tax credits themselves. And so at that point, these facilities are no longer of interest. So it's the two phases prior to actually generating revenue, essentially.
Representative Seaton.
Oh.
Did you have another follow-up?
One more follow-up, Mr.
Good,
Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Thank you. And I just want to make sure that's what I thought. Have you, in this, the first question about a different amount, could you see using a percentage or something, where you could make it project specific, but more a percentage of the overall project cost or something like that? Or would that, be a too complicated alternative?
No, I think that would be, that would be a good solution. That would allow it to be tailored to the actual size of the spend that the companies are making, and therefore their need for liquidity. So I think a percentage of the actual credits would be a better solution than a dollar number.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 10, where titled "A Leader in Alaska State Tax Credit Financings," and you're listing two of those, one for North Slope Carousel at $30 million, and the other is Cornucopia for Cook Inlet Exploration, that's Fury at $150 million. So those were two financings that of credits that you did. Have you done others as well, or is that the extent? I see nothing since the third quarter.
So we have not closed any others than those two. We have three other deals that were in the pipeline, which are sort of on hold pending some clarity on the changes to the program. And similarly, the borrowers themselves are a little bit sort of concerned because clearly their capital spend and their planning for the future is also sort of on hold pending the changes to the program.
And follow up. And the statutes that we have a amount that is appropriated for paying credits at, depending on the price of oil, either 10% of the production tax paid or below, I think it's 60, it's 15% of the production tax paid in Alaska. So is that statutory limit something that you recognize, or has that just been kind of ignored because they all the ones that a few years ago were submitted were paid?
If I understand your question correctly, so I think we've been relatively sort of that issue hasn't been material for us because all credits that were issued were paid out and there was a sort of an open-ended appropriation historically. Is that what you're asking? So we just the statutory limit, if you like, hasn't been in effect historically.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been utilized. Of course, we had high production tax rates or high production tax values that were coming to the state, so it was really not much of an issue. But where there's lower amounts, there's lower amounts of tax credits. But you're, at least the tax credit program, there is some assurance that there will be some, because it's in statute, that that amount will be appropriated. So does that seem to be a an appropriate mechanism to you to ensure that there will be money for paying those?
So that's as a mechanism to solve the appropriation risk issue. That would seem to me to be a way to fix it, yeah, if that was set at the right level, commensurate with the expected payout, that, I guess, would solve the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Is there more?
No.
Is that all you have? What's that? You have more, sir?
He's off.
Huh?
He's gone.
By golly. We'll take a brief at least to set up for the next presentation. Call the meeting back to order. Welcome, Mr. Persily. Are you on the phone, and can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Please identify yourself for the record, and please begin.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. For the record, I'm Larry Persily, Oil and Gas and LNG Project Assistant to Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navarre. I'd like to express my apologies for not being able to be there today in person. Unfortunately, we had a lot of actually oil and gas property tax work and meetings to do today in Soldotna. Now, I'd like to talk to you today mostly about Cook Inlet, Kenai Peninsula Oil and Gas Exploration Development Tax Credits, and to give some additional context to your discussions relating to those tax credit decisions in Cook Inlet. So I'll go ahead if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. Before you begin, Representative Josephson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a preliminary question, Mr. Persily, who are you speaking for?
Assuming I do my job well, I'm speaking for the mayor and the Kenai Peninsula Borough.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Proceed.
Sure. And I guess for the record, yes, I am a former deputy commissioner at the Department of Revenue and former federal official on the Alaska Gas Line, but my testimony today is on behalf of the Kenai Borough. So on the first slide, I guess I'd like to point out that as legislators, as the public, has the discussions on what to do with tax credits, when you're looking at Cook Inlet, you know, there is no production tax on oil at Cook Inlet. It hasn't been since the 80s. Natural gas production tax is hardwired at a pretty minimal rate, works out to about 2.5% of today's gas prices to the utilities. That when you look at, yes, there's royalty, property tax, corporate income tax on C corporations as opposed to other business entities. You look at the payback to the state over the years, discounts inflation, the opportunity cost, what you could have done with the money elsewhere. Realistically, honestly, you probably don't get a positive return to the state treasury, to the state general fund, on your investment. That doesn't make it wrong. It's just something, in all honesty, I think people should be aware of as you wrestle with the tough decisions. Certainly, return to the general fund is not the only way to look at what you get for those tax credits. And on the next slide, certainly from the Kenai Peninsula Borough, from the communities, from the residents down here, the local benefits are substantial. In the last 10 years, the assessed value of oil and gas property in the borough has more than doubled. In 2016, it's more than $1.4 billion. In the past year, much of the increase has come from Fury and Bluecrest, Fury developing kitchen lights offshore, Bluecrest developing Cosmopolitan on a pad onshore. The assessed value of those two entities in 2016 approaches $300 million. The top property taxpayers, no doubt, on the Kenai Borough, no surprise, oil and gas. In fact, if you look at the top 20 taxpayers in the borough, 17 of the top 20 just a couple years ago were oil and gas related. The three non-oil and gas taxpayers were Fred Meyer, Walmart, and NACS. You know, part of the state's problem, so continuing with the local benefit, sure, income's up, sales tax is back to where it was before it took a dive a few years ago, unemployment rate's down. With the borough and the communities here have a way to capture economic benefits from that activity, sales tax, property tax and new homes, and not to get into a discussion of sales tax or income tax on the state level, but that's always been part of the state's problem. Without a broad-based tax, you don't capture any benefit from the economic activity that is spurred by new oil and gas development. You're relegated to production tax, royalty, corporate income tax, and such. Certainly, the borough's not foolish. We know the good times are not going to continue. We saw it just recently with Apache saying, hey, we know there's oil. We got our Army Corps approval, but we're leaving. So just like the state, the borough knows that this is not going to continue forever on an upward trajectory, as we would say. On the next slide, the fourth one, and you've probably seen some of those numbers before, Cook Inlet is doing better, certainly, than it used to. April 2015, there was actually a time, it was 20,000 barrels a day, averaged almost 18,000 last year. It's best in a decade. Natural gas production is ahead. We just read that NSTAR has signed a contract with Hilcorp to meet most of their gas needs through 2023. Fury has signed a contract with Homer Electric starting in April to start supplying them with some natural gas supplies. There's potential, no doubt about it, for more gas in Cook Inlet. Problem is, no one's going to look for it unless there's a market for it, regardless of tax credits. So on the next slide, looking at what I created, added to, incentivized, helped move along the resurrection of Cook Inlet oil and gas, if you want to call it that, is, hey, a lot of it was higher prices. At high oil prices, it paid to explore because you could make pretty good money selling it. So, and this is not to discount that state tax credits helped because, as the prior speaker pointed out, it reduced the capital risk to your explorers. It provided financing, probably easier terms than they could get somewhere else. But high oil prices, the fact that several years ago the Regulatory Commission of Alaska changed how it looked at gas supply contracts for South Central Utilities, and that reassured producers they could get a fair return on their investment. The Cook Inlet gas storage created the year-round market for the gas, first time we've had that. As long as ConocoPhillips can continue to export during the summer when gas is surplus to local needs, that's a market. The U.S. Department of Energy has granted ConocoPhillips two more years of export authority, but there again, whether they or any other producer in South Central liquefies and sends gas overseas is going to depend on the market. I will point out that currently the spot market prices in Asia for LNG are under $5 per million BTU or per 1,000 cubic feet of gas, pretty much one or the other. If you look at Conoco's filings with federal regulators, last year they were getting $7 to $8. In 2014, they're getting $15 to $16. Like I say, today spot prices are under $5. I can't speak for ConocoPhillips, but certainly low prices in Asia are going to make it harder to export LNG from South Central. But those exports have been important in creating and enabling that year-round market. On the next slide, I think credits worked for a lot of reasons. As we talked about, you had explorers who did not have deep pockets, didn't have as easy access to investment capital. So they were looking, oil prices are high, look like there's good opportunities in South Central, but they need money to do it. You had investors around the world who looked at the low price environment or the low interest rate environment of recent years and said, I got to find something from our portfolio that's earning more than 1, 2, or 3% a year. So you had someone who needed money, someone who's looking to lend money to get a higher rate of return. It's a marriage made in Wall Street, and it worked for everyone. And the state, because we were rich with high oil prices, we could afford to take that risk, shoulder some of the burden to hopefully lead to more oil and gas production, the gas in particular, for the local market, so that that interest rate environment, the investor appetite for new opportunities, the relatively risk-free payback on the part of the state. You know, it wasn't like the state said, well, we're only going to loan to prospects that we judge to be in our best interest, or we want to see your reservoir data to decide if this is worth us putting money in. It was kind of a check the box, right? I spend the money, I turn in the application, and assuming all goes well, the investor gets the check. So that reduced the risk to the investor, worked out well, and certainly there was a lot of public support in recent years for tax credits to bring new entrants into Alaska, because we knew we're a maturing oil and gas province. We needed more money and new players. So going through the next slide, I guess what's going to happen as we look ahead. The point I want to keep making is, regardless of credits, there's got to be a market. If you help fund my exploration, if I got no place to sell that gas, I'm still not going to look for it. Oil's a little different. You can keep sending as much oil to the Tesoro refinery as you have, and that's what Bluecrest is looking at the Cosmopolitan unit. Their plan is to start producing oil this year, get it to the Tesoro refinery, and hold off on gas production until they have contracts, until they have a market for the gas, but they see a market now for the oil. You know, if you look back at the history of Cook Inlet, you needed those large customers, the fertilizer plant, the liquefaction and export terminal back in the 60s, 70s, to justify the investment to have a market for those big supplies. As we look ahead, I think that's an issue for Cook Inlet, finding that demand growth to justify large-scale production. For example, the state now has selected their preferred participant in the project to truck LNG to Fairbanks. Their plan, the contractor they selected, would take Cook Inlet gas, liquefy it, and truck it to Fairbanks. They're looking at about 8 million cubic feet a day, 4%, give or take, of Cook Inlet production. Great for Fairbanks if it works. Certainly it could work for the contractor, for the producer, but it's that volume is not enough to justify someone going out and spending a lot of money to develop a huge resource or even a large resource. We're sort of topping off the tank, I guess would be a way to look at it. Couple more slides, and the next one with the industry and investors need, as the presenter from ING pointed out, it's certainty. But, and he discussed this, right now the tax credits, the refundable tax credits, are essentially short-term, one-year loans. There may be investors who would rather, well, I shouldn't say rather, there certainly are investors who would be interested in longer-term paybacks. Someone like a pension fund may say, I don't want it all up front. I'll take a 10-year payback because that fits into my investment portfolio. I earn more interest. They just need to know going in, is this going to be a 1-year or a 10-year or a 5-year? They want that certainty, but if it's a longer payback, you'll still find investors to buy those refundable credits. And they want to see that Alaska certainly is tax stable, and that gets to the point of our budget deficit, our fiscal crisis or non-crisis, depending what term you want to use. I think all the investors are starting to look at Alaska and saying, well, I know you mean well, but I'm starting to get nervous if you're going to fund this from year to year again, as the prior speaker said. So I think in addition to dealing with tax credits and finding some solutions that the state can afford going ahead, as I'm sure legislators know, you've also got to deal with the fiscal problems so that the investors, be it oil and gas companies or the people who loan them money, feel confident that we're not all going to go through this every year. On the last slide, I don't have a proposed amendments for the perfect answer, but I think that elusive best answer is the same one that all the members of the committee are looking for. You don't want to hurt a development and investment that's underway. Reducing credits, changing credits, amending credits certainly may mean that someone who might come here, might have come here before, might not come otherwise, so you don't want to discourage future investment any more than you have to by the fact we're just not as rich as we used to be and we're cutting services and reducing funding and everyone's in there. But I think as you look and try to make those decisions, clearly it pays to look at the benefits to the state economy, the local benefits, not just the gain to the general fund, if there were, and then balance the benefits against all the other public needs you're having to make tough choices on every day on the fiscal year 17 budget and those budgets going ahead. And other than that vague advice without any specifics, I'll conclude and happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Heron.
Yes, Larry, returning to what industries/investors need, and I know you said you don't have any amendments, but could you share a couple of examples on the line, phase-in of any changes should reflect lead time?
Well, through the chair, Representative, if there's someone in, say, Bluecrest is a good example. So they plan to start oil production this year, but they're going to keep drilling wells and adding storage tanks and expanding to get up to full production, looking at gas. So I would think what the legislature would want to do is, and I'm not speaking for Bluecrest or proposing specific changes, but you want to be careful that any changes you make don't jeopardize. I guess it's more painful to jeopardize a development that's midway through construction rather than one that hasn't gotten off the ground. Someone hasn't spent any money yet, and you make changes, well, no harm, no foul to them other than they spent some time on it. But if someone has sunk a lot of money and their business plan is based on getting to X thousand barrels a day and they're at a percentage of that because they need to spend more to finish their build-out, it's just something I think the state needs to consider out of fairness and because you'll actually be seeing production from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sheehan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great to hear from you, Ms. Persley. I guess the first thing that I wanted to ask you, I think you've been following our conversations down here. Our consultants, Analytica, gave us information that $5 to $7 per MCF has been an adequate price to develop even the most expensive projects around for gas around the world. And I know you're you have some context in here about that. So with the new contracts that are going out to 2023, ending at $8.19, would your opinion be on gas projects for the local economy, at least, is that the price support of those kind of contracts basically should take care of making those economical and profitable, the gas for the Cook Inlet, South Central, and even Fairbanks region?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you know, I'm not privy to the company's capital costs, operation expenses, but clearly they've signed, Hillcorp, for example, has signed a multi-year contract with NSTAR without any assurances that in years 2017, 18, 19, 20, they're going to be getting back any tax credits. So they must feel comfortable enough in the economics to sign a deal through 2023 based on what they know today. And I guess the question is, if credits were eliminated, would that show up in a lower return to the producer or higher gas prices to customers? And my guess is it might be a little bit of both, but it probably is company specific.
Representative,
yeah, I will say, if I could, Mr. Chairman, the credits that were put in 2010 for gas storage required, and that was a Regulatory Commission of Alaska, RCA regulated regulation issue with the gas storage. The 2010 legislation required that any tax credits, benefits to the gas storage must flow through to the customers, and that RCA had to watch over that. It's a little different here, certainly, because there is no guarantee that the credits flow through to the customers. I think going back several years, the initial concern with Cook Inlet was just get gas. Worry about the price a little bit later. I'm not sure you could. I think it'd be very difficult to put in statute that every dollar of credit shows up at a dollar reduction in the bill. But again, just I guess to conclude Representative Seaton's question, a change in the credits would change the economics for sponsors. How much of it, if any, would flow through to customers in future contracts, I just don't know.
Representative Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Larry, Kurt Olson, and I'd like to ask you the same question I've asked a number of the producers that have been in front of us, but I think you'll probably bring more of a global perspective to it from your time in Washington. But can you think offhand of any other political jurisdiction, state, country, province, whatever, that has changed their tax regime six times in 10 or 11 years?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, no, I'm not aware of any that has changed them as much, but on the other hand, I'm not aware of any that has had I don't want to use the word rich, but as robust a tax credit program as Alaska either. You know, British Columbia gives some credits for road building if you're developing oil and gas fields. Alberta has some royalty relief for cost recovery. So, no, I'm not aware of any other jurisdiction in the free world, excluding Russia, which is certainly somewhat fickle as to how they apply any law. I'm not aware of any jurisdiction in a democratic society that changes as much, but on the other hand, I'm not aware of another that has as varied and multi-layered a system of tax credits as Alaska. So we sort of dug our own hole on this one.
Thanks.
A well-meaning hole, I might say.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this slide, the what industry investors need, the bullet, investors need to know the one-year loan will not be stretched into a 10-year payback. But then, as a follow-up to that, sort of talked about, well, maybe they, you know, wouldn't mind that as long as they knew that was going to happen. And so I'm just wondering if you can comment on, you know, this idea of the $25 million being too small of a cap. Say you had a scenario where you add back to that, you know, increase the cap on that, but then you spread it out so it's paid over a certain number of years. Is that the kind of thing you're suggesting, or can you comment on something like that?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that's what I'm talking about. As long as they just want to know what's going in, I think there are certainly pension funds are different than day traders. You know, myself, on my investment account, I tend to buy bonds. I don't really own any stocks. I like a little more certainty of bonds, but I want to know, is this a bond that pays off in 2020, or is this one that pays off in 2025? So investors, again, pension funds would be a good example, might look for longer-term investments. They'd rather say, hey, I'll take X percent a year, stretch over 10 years, rather than a higher rate on 1 year, because I've got a lot of money to place. I need it 10, 20, 30 years in the future. So as long as it's stated up front that, hey, we're going to do an X-year payback on these, not 1 year, I think you still have investors, as opposed to, well, we know we told you it was going to be 1 year, but we're now changing it to five. That would cause some heartburn.
Mm-hmm. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Priestley, you said something about a few minutes ago. You said, you talked about production and that one of the benefits, it's on your slide, elusive best answer, but you were commenting that one of the benefits is we'll get production. And my sense of being somewhat of a novice at this, but the last month attending hearing after hearing and attending a number of the Senate working groups and you know, sort of investing some time in this, is that my understanding is we've spent over $7 billion on credits. And if a citizen said, Andy, what have we gotten from that? I would be able to answer with a straight face, relative to the Cook Inlet Renaissance, there is utter correlation and causation. That the first made the second. And I think it's absolutely provable. It's empirically provable. As to the North Slope, I don't know. I think I'm talking to this sort of constituent in my mind's eye, and I don't know what I'd say. I mean, I have data that says everyone agrees we're going to be down to 350,000 barrels in about 6-7 years. So can you comment on that, about the merits of what we're doing on the North Slope?
Well, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I will admit, since I've been adopted by the Kenai Peninsula Borough last year, I focused more of my time on learning what's going on here rather than tracking the North Slope specifically. But you're right, Representative. It's easier to look at Cook Inlet and say credits have been a significant part of the growth in oil production and gas production, too. Certainly we don't have gas production in the sense of going to homeowners in the North Slope, and it's a little different. I guess one thing I'm thinking of, the difference is most of the refundable tax credits have gone to Cook Inlet, cash out of the Treasury, whereas in North Slope, just the way it's structured with the three major producers, has received a much smaller portion of refundable tax credits. Much of the tax credits up there have gone against tax liability. I guess if the question is how much more oil is in the pipe today that might not have been there had there not been credits, I'm like everyone else. I look at it and think, well, some, but I couldn't point to you which barrels. And I think that's the dilemma that in Cook Inlet and also the North Slope, yes, there's been certainly increased oil and gas investment and spending in Alaska, and that's good for local property taxes. For those of us who have a sales tax, it's good. For businesses, it's good. It's tough to argue long-term, you know, net present value just for inflation, that it's a profit to the general fund, but it is good for the state economy and that's the conundrum, because I think a lot of your constituents probably want to know it's a profit to the general fund.
Okay, and just
to follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My last question is about your last six words of your slides, the dependency factor. You know, my view on this is that dependency has, it certainly paid huge dividends for decades, and now it doesn't. And we had one witness, I think it was Mr. Armstrong, who said you need to concede the fact that you're a petrostate. The dependency is something we have to shake loose from, isn't it? So even though it's true, don't we need to make it false? Don't we need to find a means to break away from that?
Through the chair of Representative Josephson, no doubt. I mean, we're still, even if we, as the mayor of the Kenai Borough supports an income tax and use of permanent foreign earnings, we're still going to be an oil and gas state. But I think what we've all been learning or reaffirming for many of us is we cannot be as dependent on it as we have in the past. There just isn't enough money there. I will make one quasi-related point, if I could. We were looking at Norway's sovereign wealth fund today, which is, I don't know, $800 billion, much bigger than Alaska. But if you break it down on a per capita basis, I think Norway's got about 5 million residents. If Alaska had not paid dividends and just built up our savings account, like Norway did. Norway didn't pay dividends, doesn't pay dividends, didn't draw money for anything else. They just built it up. If we hadn't paid dividends on a per capita basis today, our permanent fund would be about equal to Norway. But we made the choice to pay it out in dividends, and that's not to attack dividends. It's just, I guess, related to your question. We've been dependent on it. We've built a financial structure, lived off of it, but can't live off of it anymore, so we're going to have to make some tough choices. And I guess acknowledging oil and gas will always be the number one industry in Alaska, but we need to diversify the revenue stream because it just can't carry us. And throwing tax credits into it isn't going to change that. Does that help with the question, Representative?
Yes, thank you.
Anybody else? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Larry, just going back and relying on a little of your, you know, history and expertise, one of the presentations we had on tax credits was looking at a hypothetically big field, which we may have on the North Slope. In fact, you know, there's kind of looking at that production at 120,000 barrels a day or so, I believe it was. But the problem is that in the next 6 years, we would have to put in $3 billion under the current bill as tax credits. And then, you know, over time, maybe make some of that back. If we have something that would be just in a single project requiring us to pay out $3 billion and then in addition to that, other projects, do you think that that's going to force Alaska to go through a entire another oil and gas tax rewrite, or do you think that would be at all sustainable to have those kinds of draws on the state budget, which aren't even included in the current projections?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know about you, but I'm turning 65 this year, and the last thing I want to live through is another oil and gas tax rewrite. I've had it. I want to read books. I think that, but it raises a good point as you look at what you want to do with oil and gas tax credits, with the floor, with the minimum, with all the issues before you in HB 247, and as Representative Olson pointed out, we have changed frequently the tax provisions in Alaska. You want to come up with the right answer, but you don't want to do something, I would think, that means in 2 years you're going to be holding special sessions on oil and gas taxes all over again. You need to come up with something, just like with the fiscal plan. You need to come up with a plan that sets up future earnings and reasonable spending so you don't have a budget crisis every year. You want to come up with that perfect answer on oil and gas taxes that is stable, stable at least for a decade. I mean, nothing lasts forever. Things change, and it's certainly the problem today is even though in our heart we may want to bring more oil and gas investment into Alaska, looking at the checkbook, we're not in a great shape to write those checks. So maybe spreading refundable credits out over time cushions it, because you're not writing all of them at $35 oil. Maybe looking at other things to do to help, rather than saying, well, I'll keep writing checks for a year and figure it out next year. It's tough. I don't envy you on some of the choices you have to make on this bill and the others.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to that point, I guess, Larry, what I've been kind of thinking of is, you know, based on what the industry has said, is something that's transitional in nature over the next year or two, and then something that we feel like could be stable for, say, 8 to 10 years after that. And from your experience looking at projects, you know, and to Rep. Olson's question about the frequency at which we're making these changes, would something like that put us more in line with other places?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, let's face it, if Alaska could come up with fiscal stability on oil and gas for 8 to 10 years, that'd be the equivalent of an eternity up here in terms of, you know, the annual or almost annual battles we've had. No, it'd be impossible to figure out something that's going to last for 50 years. Alberta just went through a royalty review. They do that on a fairly regular basis. So I think if the industry and policymakers, the legislature, could come up with something that everyone grumbled about but said they could live with it for 8 to 10 years, that'd be cause for celebration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in looking into other jurisdictions and what they do, the British Columbia example that you brought up was something I came across with the road building and infrastructure. Can you see any of those other opportunities as being advantageous for Alaska? One of the things we frequently hear is that it's much more expensive to do business here. And I'm just trying to think if there are things outside of just refundable tax credits that, you know, help on the infrastructure side that could be of interest.
Well, through the chair, Representative, you know, the state has talked about helping to build roads, the roads to resources,
right,
that we talked about. That has its own problems. You know, you want, since dollars are so precious right now, you want to make sure that you're getting something back from it. I will point out British Columbia, yes, they have some road building credits. It's a little different there because you can actually go build roads,
right,
in the fields, whereas here we know it's not. But British Columbia recently held a monthly oil and gas land lease sale, and for the first time in years, they had absolutely no bids. The market is just that bad. Prices are down. No one needs the gas. So sometimes, try as you might with credits or incentives or attractive acreage, it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Persony.
Thank you for the time, and hopefully next time I can get there in person.
Okay. Oh, be careful what you wish for, Larry.
I think you guys need moral support.
Massages.
Our next meeting will be on Thursday, March 11th at 1 p.m. We have scheduled House Bill 246, Aid of Funds, Loans, Programs, and Dividends. Mm-hmm. Is there any further business before the committee this afternoon?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I ask the chairs, just for a general sense of particularly this bill, that is House Bill 247, what's anticipated for March, for our calendars, to the extent you know and can share that?
What's this now? I'm sorry.
Just for my own scheduling and planning, a sense of when this bill might be taken up.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I think the way things are going, You know, we have a lot of things we need to talk about. You know, we're talking about a whole lot of things that are going to be affecting the budget. And so we want to understand more of what's happening and what's being planned and all that. So, okay. I mean, we just have a whole lot of stuff that we need to talk about. Okay. Tomorrow's aid of funds, loans, programs, dividends, and all that stuff. Boy, there's some other stuff out there. So I have no idea.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Good luck to you. Is there any further business for the committee this afternoon? If not, we are adjourned at 3:05 p.m.